Hi, Patrick Cox here with the World in Words monthly news roundup. One of my worldy pals and I will pick five language-related news stories, stories that seem, well, worth chatting about. So, coming up in descending order are five stories from the month of July, plus a little thing about despicable words. In the big studio with me is the world's online editor, Clark yes. Boyd. Hi, Clark.
Hi, Patrick.
Clark also puts out the world's technology podcast.
That's right.
And Clark, you have story number five.
I do have story number five, and this one's near and dear to my heart because I lived in Hungary for a while, many years ago. But this is a little story. Actually, the story starts north of Hungary in Slovakia, and the Slovak parliament has come up with this law that they want to pass that would essentially fine people for using minority languages, and by minority languages they mean Hungarian, in certain communities, in communities where less than 20% of the population of those communities is of another ethnicity. So what they're talking about here are the towns down along the border with Hungary. And to understand this situation fully, you have to understand that during World War I, Hungary was allied with Austria. They were on the losing side of that war, as any Hungarian will tell you, and they lost about two-thirds of their land in the settlements, in the Trianon settlements after World War I. So you have ethnic Hungarian communities that are kind of spread all along the Slovak border. Of course, in Romania, there's some too. And needless to say, Hungarian parliamentarians are not too happy about this Slovak idea of punishing people for using Hungarian in official capacities in these communities.
Sure. Are they worried about some kind of separatist movement or something? Or they just don't like Hungarians?
Well, if you ask Hungarians, they'll tell you it's because they don't like Hungarians. But it's you know, as with all things in that part of the world, it's kind of hard to say what's going on here. The Hungarians and the Slovaks love to bait each other over just about everything. I remember when I was living there, one of the big things was the Slovaks were always threatening to basically dam up the Danube River and not let the Hungarians have any water. And then this was a flashpoint. So the fact that the language is a flashpoint here is not surprising at all. And you find that there are going to be a lot of those communities that this would affect along there, because quite a few of those towns along those borders probably would be much more than 20%.
Right. And we're not talking about two languages that are related at all. I mean these have come from completely different roots.
That's the other thing that you have to understand here, is that Hungary is this – I mean, it's literally landlocked, but it's completely isolated. It's like this little linguistic island there, surrounded by all the Slavic languages. And Hungarian is put together completely differently than the Slavic languages. And Hungarians really hold on to that. And I think that's another reason why this is such a flashpoint for the Hungarians who are fighting against this, is that they hold on very dearly to this language. And they realize that they're isolated and surrounded and they feel picked on.
Clark, you did let slip that you have personal experience of this neck of the woods and that you lived in Hungary.
That's true.
Why?
I was teaching English. Well, no, wait a minute. I could breathe and I could speak English. And this was 1992. The wall had just come down. And if you could breathe and speak English, they would be more than happy to let you stand up in front of a room full of people in Eastern Europe and teach them English. That's what I was doing. I was standing up in front of rooms of people who had been learning Russian their whole lives and had been forced to learn Russian their whole lives. And in Hungary, you have to remember, many of my students were very, very proud of the fact that they had taken 12 years of Russian and didn't speak a word of it. They probably did speak a word of it, but they were very proud that we'd never use it. And so I was teaching in a small teacher's training college that literally went from having a Russian department of 400 students and 20-some professors and having no English department. And then the year I came, suddenly there were 350 students learning English and 20 of us, you know, young kids teaching them. And the Russian department had like 12 students left and one professor. And that's how quickly the change was made.
Wow.
It was very, very hard. Wow. It was very, very hard. So what's story number four?
Well, story number four is, I guess, something that will not be very closely followed in Slovakia or Hungary, because it's about raising your kids bilingually, which doesn't seem as though there's much of an incentive in that neck of the woods to do that. There is new research out this month about how you acquire more than one language. Now, in the past, I think as recently as 15 or 20 years ago, all of the research pointed to the fact that if you were raising a kid bilingually, they were actually developing their language skills just a little bit slower than people who were being raised monolingually. Research since then is suggesting otherwise. Mm. This latest study, this is out of Italy, it reports that for kids learning two languages from scratch as babies, it's far easier than learning one and then the other. Mm. Once you've mastered a language, it gets in the way of learning a second. So babies, they can learn two radically different sound patterns, and that was how they did the test, through sound patterns, at the same time. Now, if you learn one sound pattern and then you mastered it, and then learned a second sound pattern, you'd never really get that second sound pattern.
So that's why it's hard for us at age, whatever we are, to come back and try to learn a second.
Yeah, and for those of us who are trying.
Yeah, I know.
But anyway, I mean, this is another sort of nail in the coffin for this belief that somehow speaking two languages from birth holds you back in some way. In fact, most of the recent research suggests that there's great improvement, whether it's for staving off dementia in later years or for improving your executive functions. Everything now points to raising a kid bilingually.
Wow, interesting. Let's make a radical shift here for story number three. I had to choose this one. I do cover technology for the show. And as part of covering technology for the show, I have always tried to steer clear of the wacky gadget from Japan story.
Right.
Because everybody loves to cover the wacky gadget from Japan story. Mm. However, in this case, we just have to.
You have a wacky gadget from Japan.
Strangely enough, it's not only that, but this one's really going to touch a chord with you dog lovers out there. There is a Japanese toy maker who has developed a device which they claim can translate dog into human language.
You mean woof woof?
Woof woof. Your dog wears a microphone around its neck. And, of course, the sound is picked up. And then there's a handheld device. It looks about the size of like a little Nintendo Game Boy, strangely enough. And it analyzes, and I'm using quotation marks here, the dog's sound patterns. And using what the researchers call a special algorithm, which is always code for we really don't know what's going on. But using a special algorithm, it displays, in Japanese, of course, what your dog is apparently feeling, and then a little emoticon, so like a little happy, sad. And apparently it can detect six different moods: frustration, joy, sadness. There's even an answering machine function so that you can just leave this device on all day. There's a phone number. It's recording all this to an answering machine device, and you can call in and see how your doggy's doing during the day, whether your dog's sad or not.
Oh, right. And maybe your dog was sad at 2 p.m., but by 4, you know, things
you come
have taken
home
a
and
turn.
It's happy. Yeah. All for $220. Only available in Japan for right now. Smart Money says this thing comes out in the States before the end of the year, probably right around Christmas time.
Yeah. Do you really want to know, though, what your dog is thinking or saying? I mean, don't you just want to keep that idealized, like he loves me no matter what?
Yeah. My first reaction, I'm not a dog owner. I like dogs, but I don't own one. I have a cat. My thing was, it's like, now, if you could find something that speaks cat, now, then you'd really be onto something here, because if I could figure out what was going on in my cat's mind.
Oh, yeah, they're
I'd
much more
happier.
Mysterious.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Okay, now another radical shift. Malaysia. The Malaysian government has been conducting something of an experiment for the last 6 years, which is teaching science and math in English. It's been doing this because right next door in Singapore, the language of instruction for all subjects is English. And you look at what's happened to Singapore over the last few decades and the economic miracle there. A lot of people believe that's down to the fact that everybody speaks great English and has learned, you know, English concepts as a result of having been taught in English. So the Malaysians decided to try the same thing. There was a big backlash outside of the cities. It was very difficult to find teachers who actually could speak good English, good enough to actually teach, you know, highly technical language.
Yeah, those are very technical things to try to teach.
You know, and then you have in the schools, you have a linguistic divide somewhat. I mean, there's some of the schools use Chinese Mandarin as the language of instruction. Others use Tamil or Bahasa Malay, which is, I think, the most popular language, especially in rural areas. You know, you're talking about almost 100% ethnic Malay people. And there were riots, there were protests that went bad earlier this year.
Over this issue? Over the teaching of science and
exactly.
Wow, amazing.
And as a result, the Malaysian government has bowed to the will of those people, and there has been an immediate backlash from others, especially sort of urbanites who wanted for their kids the best opportunities, which they saw as being provided for them through the instruction.
Part of this, too, the whole idea that if we don't teach our kids science and math and English, then they're never going to get into grad school in the United States, where they need to come to really... to do their master's work, to do their PhD work.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And, you know, if not the United States, then Singapore.
Then Singapore, right, because they're doing everything in English.
Right.
You know, it's interesting because my wife just got back from Ethiopia and she was doing a roundup of higher ed in Ethiopia. And she found something very similar. Even in the outlying, very far outlying universities in Ethiopia, the big sign that you saw whenever you entered any department there was all students must speak English at all times.
Wow.
I mean, so this is not only places like Malaysia that this is going on. This is happening around the world. And again, my question was, geez, do they have enough teachers who can teach the science and math? And of course, in Ethiopia, you're talking more like agriculture, hydraulics, things like that. They're teaching very practical things there. And, you know, my wife said for the most part, the undergrad level, the English was not so good among the students. But at the grad level, the master's levels, the people doing their degrees there, the English was quite good.
Okay. Number one story.
The
Clark
number
Boy.
One, swearing. Let's just get it out there. Right
Boy,
now.
Clark, how do you relate to that?
Well, we like to joke that there is a very large, what we call the swear jar at home. And whenever Clark swears, he has to throw a quarter into it. And it's full. Probably has enough for my daughter's college fund already. And that's only after 3 years. So this new study that just came out in this journal called Neuro Report, the way they did this was great. They were measuring how long college students could hold their hands in ice cold water. Okay, this is a great one to get college students. Yeah, you could just see, we'll give you $10 if you come in here and hold your hand in this water for as long as you can.
Normally we say don't try this at home, but I would say do try this at home.
Yeah, and exactly. This is going to be the point coming up. Do try this at home. So they had the students put their hands in water, and their students could choose to do one of two things. They could either choose to repeat an expletive of their choice or a neutral word. And the students who chose to repeat an expletive lasted about 40% longer with their hands in the water than the students who didn't. This research was done by Keele University in the UK. And the guy who directed it, his quote was, I would advise people, if they hurt themselves, to swear. I'm taking that to heart. I might get that printed on a T-shirt. But what they think is going on here, and of course this is all speculation, they need follow-up studies, is that the use of that expletive is so emotionally charged that it's triggering the same kind of thing that happens with a fight or flight response. I mean, this is like deep reptilian brain kind of stuff here. It's like you are letting go of something that you know is a very emotionally charged, that you know you shouldn't be saying, that is socially unacceptable, but it's literally helping you through whatever kind of pain or suffering that you're experiencing.
So you tolerate it better by transgressing certain societal...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And actually, that was one of the other points that they brought out with this, was that over-swearing, overuse of a particular word, lessens its impact.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you use this particular swear word too much and you were using it in a situation like this, then it wouldn't give you
not
as much
work.
It wouldn't
yeah.
give you as much pain relief as it normally would otherwise.
That may also account for the fact that there are always new swear words out there, always being developed. I mean,
exactly.
We kind of just use them up so quickly. There's always a bowl of ice there to put your hand
That's
in.
That's right. Exactly.
Wow. Number one. Okay. Well, there is one more story that seemed worth talking about. Maybe it's not part of a top five thing, but it's a kind of a parlor game story. This was a question that was posed at a poetry festival in England. What word do you hate and why? This kind of went viral when various blogs and the news media picked up on it, and people have been offering all kinds of things, including I put something out on Twitter and got a few responses back too. But let's start with the poets because, you know, they're wordsmithy type people, I guess. So somebody came up with this word. I have no idea, by the way, how to pronounce this. Pulchritude. Do you know how to say that?
I would say pulchritude.
Pulchritude.
But I bet somebody out there listening to the podcast will be able to correct us if we're wrong.
Please do. But it means beautiful. And this that was...
That was
the problem that this particular poet, Philip Wells, this was the winner, that was the problem that he had with it, was that it sounds kind of the opposite of beautiful.
It does. I have to admit that.
Another one was redacted. Mm. Another one was the word appall, which you understand why it really, really upsets this particular poet when I tell you his name. Paul Batchelor.
Oh, well, of course. Yeah. Well, that's the point with all of these, I think. That most of them are incredibly subjective, right?
Right.
A word that sounds awful to me probably has some association with it that I don't like, that it's been used in a context that I don't like.
Right. Well, on that subject, what is a word that sounds awful to you?
Well, you know, the word that I'm really disliking these days is, and it's kind of funny, benign.
Benign.
Benign. And let me tell you why. The word benign sounds very benign. But when it's used with this particular phrase, benign positional vertigo...
that doesn't sound so benign anymore.
No, and it's not. And the thing that I don't like about benign is that it's used in that way and lurking just beneath the surface. It's like, oh, your tumor. Your tumor's just benign. I mean, there's always like something just behind it that's kind of ready to reach up and grab you, like something much worse is behind it. When they use that word, I have a reflex now that says... Oh, they don't really mean it's benign. I mean, something awful is going to happen. In the case of my vertigo, which I had recently, the entire room was spinning for about 5 days. That's not benign, folks.
That is not benign. come to think of it, benign really is a kind of an apology word
for
something that is much worse. The expression benign dictator. I mean, it's still a dictator, people.
Exactly.
I mean, benign or otherwise. It's
the threat that's always there. That the benign dictator can turn and not be so benign in like a blink of an eye.
Mr. Malevolent.
Exactly.
Yes. So anyway, okay, all right. I'm with you on benign.
Let's hear yours.
Well, here's one that I really dislike. This is not in common usage, but I saw it coined recently. Dad rock. Dad rock is... I was listening to a piece of music, which I quite liked, and I saw a review of it a few days later, and it described it as dad rock. In other words, rock music that dads would like. And I'm afraid I've never played that CD since. I was so appalled at being sort of categorized
appalled.
As a lover.
You were so appalled.
Sorry, Paul.
I was
so appalled at being categorized as a lover of dad rock that it just had to go, flung it out.
Well, I urban dictionaried that one because what I was really worried about was that there was going to have a list of examples and it was going to pretty much mirror what was on my, you know, CD shelf or in my iPod. And there were a few in there that I may not be listening to anymore because of that exact same. I mean, I am a dad. I do listen to rock. But the whole idea of dad rock, too, I find that slightly nauseating.
All right. One more from you, Clark.
Well, I don't like the word homeland.
Mm.
And ever since it's been coined with this homeland security...
Mm.
And I saw a bumper sticker a couple of days ago on a truck around here, Homeland Defense, which I don't even know what that, you know, and I guess I just don't understand the use of that in that particular thing. I've never thought, I grew up in America, I am an American, this is my country, but I would never go around saying America is my homeland.
It also suggests there's an away land that is somehow less friendly.
Yeah, I know. And it seems to me that kind of word has just fed into this whole idea of it's like us, them.
Right, absolutely.
It's just such a divisive kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so I just don't like that word very much.
Well, along the same lines, I have a real beef with the word alien. Not surprisingly, when I first came to this country, I was an alien. I saw somebody the other day actually say that there was no pejorative connotation for the word alien as far as the U.S. government is concerned, which strikes me as utterly ridiculous because alien, for me, I mean, it's this sci-fi connotation.
Oh, totally.
It's like if you're not...
Something so incredibly different.
Right. If you're not American, you're from a different planet.
That's exactly right.
And then I saw in the New Yorker the other day a couple of sheriff deputies were being interviewed, and one of them referred to... Let me just find it, because it's... Here we are. We can now determine alienage. So it's alien, A-G-E, alienage, which is horrifying
it's
to think
that
it
might... It's
not even
a word. I mean, that,
oh, it's not a word.
You can't even find that in a dictionary anywhere, can you? I mean...
That just made me think that we've got some mission creep on a word that already is pretty offensive.
If only we could find the aliens their own homeland.
Well, on that note, Clark, It's been fantastic. Thank you very much.
Always a pleasure, Patrick.
And you can find Clark's technology podcast at
theworld.org/technology.
Thank you, doggy translators of Japan. Please send me your submissions for stories to include next month. You can find me all over the place, on Facebook, at the World in Words group page. I'm also on Twitter. You can email me. The address is language@pri.org, or go to theworld.org/language. More podding in a few days. Until then, bye.